Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington.
Today, we close out our TWIMLCon coverage with a panel on operationalizing responsible AI. But first, a quick announcement. Have you been enjoying our TWIMLCon coverage but want more? TWIMLCon video packages are now available for advanced purchase over at twimlcon.com/videos. The package features over 13 hours of content, including all the awesome keynotes and panels you've heard on the podcast, all of the breakout sessions, including 9 case study and 8 tech track sessions, as well as the highly regarded team teardown panels with Airbnb and SurveyMonkey. Again, visit twimlcon.com/videos for more info. And now, on to the show.
I am really excited to welcome up a panel that's going to talk through a really important topic, operationalizing how we do machine learning and AI ethically. And to lead us through that, I'm excited to have our moderator for the panel, Kari Johnson from VentureBeat, and he will introduce the rest of the panel. Kari and panel, welcome to TWIMLCon.
Good afternoon. My name is Kari Johnson, and I'm senior AI staff writer at VentureBeat, and really excited to be here with our panel. I could introduce everyone, but I think everyone will do a better job if they do it themselves. We'll just quickly go down the row, but we can begin with a quick icebreaker, I think, if that's all right. I was thinking icebreakers are, they can be corny. That's possible, but sometimes they also let you know a little bit about the other people, too. So when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up? I'll go first. I wanted to be a firefighter, but I also asked my mom to do an op-ed on local television about why kids don't need to take showers. So it could be that I'm doing what I always wanted to be.
I wanted to be a politician and ultimately a president.
Nice.
Well, I wanted to be a writer. I actually wanted to write novels, and I write Scala code. So yeah, here we are. Yeah.
At various points, I wanted to be a nurse, marine biologist, archaeologist, and writer.
These are all good professions. I think we're doing good stuff too. But again, down the line, if we could start with Perry, and can you please correct me on the correct pronunciation of your name and tell us a little about the current work that you do?
Sure. I'm Pari Naz. I'm coming from Georgia Part. I work for Georgia Partners right now. For those of you who are not familiar with Georgia Partners, we are a venture capital based in Toronto, biggest private fund in Canada, so investing in growth stage companies, SaaS, software, and services. And our business plan and model is a little bit different. We have impact team where I'm coming from in addition to the investment team. We are like an applied research lab for our portfolio companies, de-risking research and innovation for them and accelerating their adoption of cutting-edge disruptive technologies such as machine learning and AI. So we are a team of practitioners working on R&D projects with our companies.
Awesome. So I'm Guillaume, which is French for William. So if my first name is too hard to pronounce, feel free to call me William or even Bill if you must. Essentially, so I lead computational science at LinkedIn, which is a team that's heavily invested in fairness. I assume I probably don't need to introduce LinkedIn, but if you don't know what it is, you should check it out. It's a pretty cool it's a pretty cool network. And essentially, you know, what I've primarily worked on lately is specifically about like the experimentation side of fairness and responsible design.
I'm Rachel Thomas, and I'm director of the Center for Applied Data Ethics at the University of San Francisco, which we just launched a few months ago, so it's still very new. And I'm focused on kind of harms that are happening now. So that includes unjust bias, surveillance and the erosion of privacy, and disinformation. And at the center, we'll be kind of working on a mix of research, education, and policy. Yeah, I'm also co-founder of Fast AI, where we're interested in kind of getting people from more diverse backgrounds into AI.
So just to get us started, how do you get started with operationalizing AI ethics? What do you feel like are the first steps that an organization should be taking to set the table?
That's a very good question. I believe you have to start with the vision, your vision of the company. And that's what we always value a lot when we are doing the due diligence. Then, of course, the culture is also very important. Teams, do you have the right team in place? And you have to understand that, of course, you are building softwares, but most of these issues started from not having diverse teams working on these software products. So it's really important to start by building a diverse team, not only in terms of the gender or ethnicity, but maybe we need to have new roles in our machine learning or data science teams. Maybe we need sociologists. Maybe we need somebody with legal and compliance background. So it's not only about, okay, let's have equal number of women and men or from different ethnicity, but it's also about maybe thinking about diversity in the background of the team. And at the end, there is like the question of what kind of processes do we need in place to be able and enable the team to build responsible, ethical AI products.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think values and vision are very, very important. I mean, we found that, you know, we can't really have just one central team that writes one piece of code and fixes fairness, for example, for the whole company. And so it's really everyone's problem. Everyone kind of is involved in this. And so what that means is that you really have to have the right alignment in terms of values and culture. So when you join LinkedIn, first thing they tell you before you even sit down is like members first, right? So if you have a doubt, you always put the member first and also act like an owner. And I think once everyone kind of feels like, okay, you know, being fair, treating the members fairly and as the way I would want to be treated myself, when everyone is kind of behind that, it makes it a lot easier. And of course, you know, to get started practically, you also want to have the right tools and the ways to measure and kind of the right processes. But really, without culture and without the values, it's actually, I think, very hard to do anything, given the fact that it's really kind of a broad effort that everyone should take ownership of.
Yeah. Yeah, and for concrete resources, one resource I highly recommend is the Markkula Center has a toolkit for tech ethics, and they recommend kind of a number of processes you can implement, but a key one is ethical risk sweeps. And so this is kind of periodically scheduling times to really go through kind of what could go wrong and like what are the ethical risks, because I think a big part of ethics is also kind of thinking through what can go wrong before it does and having processes in place around what happens when there are mistakes or errors.
Diving a bit deeper into that, what does the panel think about in terms of favorite frameworks or approaches or different tools that are available and out there now that that teams can use?
So let's start with what are under the umbrella of responsible AI, what are my main concerns? Privacy is one of them. And not only about the tools, but also about the technology. I really believe in differential privacy and federated learning to build privacy-preserving machine learning products and systems. In terms of explainability and communication with the end users, or actually debugging, enabling developers to debug the systems, I really like approaches like Lime or A-Lime or Anchor Lime. In terms of fairness and bias, I believe it's really important to root out bias. So I personally use the tool developed by EPFL University and I guess Columbia University. Its name is FairTest, Discovering Unwarranted Associations in Data-Driven Applications, and Google What If tool. They are also my favorites. And I guess that's it.
Yeah.
And we recently also open sourced our TensorFlow tool for building privacy-preserving machine learning systems.
Yeah, we have similar kind of areas that we care about. I would say LinkedIn, there's a lot of internal tools that we're also building. Some of it is that there are some great tools out there that don't always scale, and you know, we have a lot of data that we have to kind of like process. And we also have some tools that we're kind of building kind of completely of our own. So for example, we have a lot of fairness built into experimentation, right? The idea is like it's not just about the algorithm. It's not just about are you fair from like an algorithmic perspective? But, like once your outputs are put in front of humans, what kind of outcomes are we seeing between like treatment and control, things like this. And so that's also the kinds of, we also care a lot about that, which is try to think about it when you train your data, when you first put together your training data, when you train your model, and then even in an ongoing basis, how does it interact with people? How does it interact with users? And so we try to cover all of that, at least, the whole kind of like machine learning and AI life cycle.
Yeah, going along with that, I think that some of the issues that arise from not thinking about the whole system and so kind of how the different parts interact, I think a lot of tech kind of encourages us to kind of, you know, hyper-specialize, and it's really important for people across different groups to be talking. One great idea I've heard from Alex Fierst is having having trust and safety embedded with engineering, product, and design, because they have, you know, trust and safety is kind of seeing what can go wrong and what happens when it does, and that, you know, engineering, product, and design tend to live in a bit more optimistic world. But I really think having kind of those communication channels open between groups, and also having kind of all the necessary stakeholders, like everyone that's going to be impacted downstream involved.
What do you feel like are some of your biggest concerns as it relates to responsible AI today? Or to put it another way, if you could change one thing about the AI ethics debate today, what would it be?
I think I might actually say, like, focusing a bit more on harm and less on bias. I think sometimes we get focused on our algorithms and we're like, oh, there's bias. And I think there's a sense in which, like, you know, every algorithm is going to be biased somewhat, but you might see very different types of harm. But so at LinkedIn, we're about people's careers. And so we actually are very mindful of, like, are we helping everyone, you know, kind of like get ahead in their careers? And so in terms of kind of shifting the debate, I think there's a sense in which it's sometimes a little too focused on kind of the algorithm itself and kind of the bias of the algorithm versus kind of like taking a little step back and kind of thinking about harm more globally.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Like, I think bias is an important issue, but it's just one of many, and kind of looking at harms, and particularly harms that are already happening when there are mistakes. You know, we've seen mistakes of an algorithm cutting off healthcare incorrectly for Medicaid benefits, of teachers wrongly being fired, that kind of there are things already happening and understanding those. And I think one of the dynamics that comes into play is that algorithmic systems can make it harder for anybody to feel responsible. And, you know, bureaucracy does this as well, but often algorithms are kind of extending bureaucracy. And this is an idea Dana Boyd has talked about. But that's something that alarms me, and we need to talk more about, of kind of how we build systems where we can feel responsible for the outcomes, because that's important.
Yeah, I believe also, I do agree with the two of you, but I also believe that we need to have machine learning specific quality assurance processes. And also we have to have like a guardrails, fault tolerance, and we have to have a plan for when things can go wrong. And we have to reduce the impact of models' errors, especially for more critical decision-making or applications. One of the problems I had so far is, like, some people believe maybe that these systems are perfect or they can be perfect down the road. But I personally believe, because they are probabilistic systems, that we are using them for deterministic decision making, we might never reach to 100% performance. So it's really important to have guardrails.
I totally agree with that. And I would add one other point also is to ask about just what are the things we shouldn't be doing at all. I think sometimes people skip to this, like, oh, how do we debias the data? You know, and we're seeing this a lot with facial recognition of, like, oh, you know, we need to debias it and have more faces of people of color. But we also need to ask, like, you know, should we be using facial recognition this much at all? And in these use cases, and really kind of pausing at the start too.
When it comes to that idea of, like, public perception, you know, you were talking about people believing that it can be a perfect system. It seems like maybe part of the process as well is teaching, or at least having public education stuff out there so that people understand that these are probabilistic systems and they're making predictions based on data.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Education is a key.
Yeah.
For both, not only for the end users, but also for the developers, product leads, or the executive teams in general.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would also add on that I think in some cases, tech companies bear some responsibility for overhyping what they're selling, mm-hmm. And then are kind of, you know, preying on that. Often people purchasing these products don't have the understanding of probability that they need, or have these misconceptions that AI is 100% accurate. But I think we also have a real responsibility to not overpromise or oversell the capabilities of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely a lot of marketing injected into the AI space. Guillaume, I was curious if you could talk a little bit about sort of the practical challenges of scaling responsible AI within a large organization. And as an aside to that, if you think of sort of those rules as different for the organization-wide approach as opposed to, like, specific teams within the company.
Yeah. So as I briefly mentioned, it's really, you know, it really starts with the values kind of in the culture. And then, you know, it starts with, essentially, we also found that it's hard to just have one rule that applies to everybody. And so what we try to do is kind of give ourselves the tools, the measurement tool, the analysis tool, the experimentation tools that we can then kind of like deliver to specific teams. And we work with them to figure out like what makes sense for their specific vertical, right? And importantly, we also care about kind of the final output once it's in, once there's an experiment and people are interacting with it. And so, you know, we really try to have like a 360 degree view of the whole process and make sure that, you know, kind of every part of the process is covered. So say you train an algorithm, for example, you know, we'd like you to be aware, like whether it's, let's say, a gender representative or something like that. And so, you know, we try to make sure that people have the information in front of their eyes when it's available. And we also have, you know, we just kind of have a lot of meetings where we just kind of discuss whether this is the right thing or not the right thing. You know, my sense that it has to be decentralized to an extent. And so this is also why, you know, when we analyze all the experiments and we look at what's happening with the fairness metrics, and sometimes people have like really fairness enhancing things, but they didn't know they did. It's just a really happy accident. And we also want to be able to like see that and reward that and kind of learn from what they did that worked, right? And so really we're trying to have this kind of like decentralized approach where everyone's an owner.
What are some of the sort of major AI systems that are used at LinkedIn?
So essentially we have the feed, we have, you know, the recommendations. So essentially, you know, these are built into, potentially they can be used by everything basically. So to give you a couple of examples, one that uses this heavily is the when we rank candidates, so job candidates. You're a recruiter, you log into LinkedIn, you see potential candidates, right? And so those we make sure that they're representative. And so there, you know, we actually make sure that when you see, let's say your first list of candidates, it's actually representative of the, you know, population distribution, the underlying talent pool. And it's just, you know, and the bias there is like we're being very, very careful that you're seeing something as representative. So that's one example.
Yeah. And for the panel, just I'm curious what you think about in this age of AI, how this ethos of move fast and break things with startups has evolved or changed, if at all.
Yeah, I believe generally it's much harder for startups to proactively prioritize responsible and ethical use of AI. It's been kind of overwhelming effort and endeavor for them. And that's why we gave them a framework in our team. We provided the principles and framework for them. And we try to kind of educate them that trust and responsible AI is a, you can think of it in terms of two-dimensional space, where one dimension is the value you deliver to your customers, and the other dimension is the level of comfort. So of course the value is like the actual product you are building, and then level of comfort can be it's mainly about data ownership and do customers have any opinion in your product roadmap or not, privacy and security, one of the most important ones, and explainability and transparency. Do your customers know how their data is used or end users, and for what kind of purposes you are using that data, and do they have, based on this new compliance, for example, GDPR, right to delete their data from your existing databases or even fingerprints from your machine learning systems?
Is this something you've run across at the Center for Applied Data Ethics? I know you guys are just getting started, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, I think that kind of looking at like on a long time horizon, I think being ethical is a kind of like a profitable decision. And I think there is this real conflict of interest, though, with there's so many short-term pressures and pressures to focus on the short-term. And that's something that is tough to crack. And I think that it's great to hear about like a venture firm working on that, because I think often the incentives around venture capital and kind of just our current corporate ecosystem push people on short term, and that it does take a longer time horizon to think about ethical behavior and the financial benefits of ethical behavior. I think that there are deeper benefits to ethical behavior in the short term as well.
Yeah, and I think, and also like if there's also the risk that like if you're very biased, you might only kind of cater to one population, right? And so eventually that limits the growth of your user base. So even from a business perspective, you actually want to have everyone come on board, right? And so I agree with you. I think it's actually good business in the long run to actually be responsible and worry about this. I would say though, I don't think LinkedIn ever really was kind of move fast and break things, as far as I can tell. If you're an ML engineer, sometimes you can kind of get carried away and maybe you forget what you're working on. But at LinkedIn, at least, you know, when you're working on like something that's about jobs, it kind of like puts this, you know, you kind of realize like, okay, like this is important. and how would I want people to treat my resume and my own job? And so my sense is like, and of course I wasn't around when the company was created, but you know, it seems like for a very long time at least, it's been about responsibility and kind of like putting members first.
So I've got two more questions, and then I'm going to open it up and see if there's any questions from the audience. One of them was, you know, Rachel and I were talking about this before we got started today, and it's like, so the Pope was talking about AI ethics effectively at a tech conference in Vatican City a couple days ago, which is something I want to see pictures of or something. It must be interesting. But I mean, and then, you know, they're essentially talking about a need for protection of the common good from AI perspective as well as tech. And, you know, other ones, examples of AI ethics coming up in the context of power and AI, it feels like a word that's been missing from a lot of conversations around artificial intelligence. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and someone else, Joy Boulam-Winney, having a long exchange about the systems working best on white men and not as well on women of color, for example. It seems present in a lot of these. And this is a very long-winded way of asking how the panel, if there are any specific ways that you see this power dynamic playing out in the AI ethics conversation today.
I think, you know, this is also one place where like diversity is like super important, right? Because essentially the people who are in the room making the decision about like what should be fair will kind of refer to their own experience. And so that's why, you know, it's very important to like make sure that both in the company and also like kind of like inside, you know, your development teams, like there's actually as much diversity as possible so that the decision kind of is made in a way that's kind of like kind of conscious of everyone's kind of, you know, approaches. I think, you know, it's really diversity is probably one of the best way to get started on that.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point you bring up. I would say one area I think we see it a lot in is surveillance technology, which tends to kind of disproportionately be applied against poor people. We've also seen instances of, you know, Baltimore police using facial recognition to identify protesters protesting the death of Freddie Gray. And those things definitely have this kind of clear power differential. And, you know, even looking at history, kind of how surveillance technology has been used to suppress dissent and moves for positive social change. Power is a very important dynamic.
One last thing before asking the audience if you have any questions, to end on a positive note, do you have any favorite examples of AI ethics success stories where an organization or team was able to resolve some challenges or confront them?
I was working with one of our companies, Turnitin. They are also based on Valley. And we were building a plagiarism detection tool mainly for investigators and teachers, to mostly for universities and K-12 institutes. And so it's basically using NLP, all your kind of authorship style, not using any PII, not using any student performance, grades, anything. But at the end of like development process, we get together and, because I'm not a native speaker, I ask a question like, is it possible that our model has, for example, more false positive rate against non-native speakers? And because, you know, like we historically, there might be more instances of like plagiarism for non-native speakers, and the model, and we know machine learning is all about correlation, not necessarily causation, and the model might have picked up those kinds of, for example, grammatical errors as the signs for example, plagiarism. And we started testing our system and we used the FAIR test and we realized, yes, there is a potential problem and we actually could mitigate and address such bias in the system.
Oh, so I have two small examples on this. So one that I briefly mentioned is the representative ranker. So when you look for candidates, you essentially see something that's representative. The second one is something that we actually discovered when we analyzed the experiment. So it was kind of a surprise, but it turns out, so we have this feature that sends like job notifications instantly. So, you know, when there's a job that's good for you, you instantly get notified. And we looked at the metrics and we're like, wow, this is like really equalizing. So, you know, it seems like people who were not too engaged or like didn't have like that great networks, you know, or were kind of categories that, you know, we thought were a bit disengaged. These people are just, we see the metrics go way up and we wonder why. And it turns out, you know, like people tend to self-censor when applying to jobs. They're like, oh, maybe I'm not qualified enough, maybe I've done good enough, or I can see there's already people applied, I don't want to do it. And so it turns out that like when an algorithm tells you, hey, we think you should apply to this, you'd be good for this, that can also be empowering. And so that's a success story there, which is, we just found out that like some of these algorithms actually help people and actually reduce the gap between the categories that we might care about. And so, yeah, these are two stories that I was pretty happy about. Yeah.
Yeah, a story I like is from Meetup. Evan Estola, the lead machine learning engineer, shared that when they were building their recommendation system to recommend meetups to people, they realized there was the potential for a feedback loop of fewer women are interested in technical meetups. So then the algorithm might recommend even fewer meetups to women, tech meetups. So you would have fewer women attending and kind of create this feedback loop pretty quickly. And so they decided to short circuit that from the start. And I really like that story because it's also an instance of kind of not just unthinkingly trying to optimize a metric, but thinking about the outcome and the taking the responsibility around feedback loops seriously.
Nice. And any questions from the audience? There we go.
I use this. Speak into the lapel.
Alrighty. So, with the rise of deep learning, a lot of more principled approaches have fallen to the wayside in favor of empiricism.
This is going to be a long question, isn't it?
Not very long. No. I see that a lot in natural language processing. But in the case of ethics and AI, how do you think principled approaches fit in?
Can you give an example of what you mean by principled approaches?
So I work on machine translation, and we've seen a shift towards byte pair encodings using subwords that don't necessarily have any meaning by themselves, as opposed to using a large vocabulary of whole words. So we can't inspect why a model attributes a decision to the subwords themselves as intelligently as before. It's kind of in conflict with deep learning's empirical approach to AI, but I'm wondering, do you think it can come back?
So kind of what do you do when your techniques abstract away from your ability to be fair, in a sense?
A little bit.
Yeah, so I would say I think the why is generally always a hard question, right? So we try to focus kind of at first as like we're seeing some metrics about, you know, is the performance the same for groups that we care about? How people interact with it? And even with this, even when the techniques are simple, the why is always kind of a difficult question. Like, why is it that we're seeing this? Right? Like, what is it about the algorithm? And sometimes it's not the algorithm, it's about the people. And so when it's about people, like figuring the why is very, very complicated. And so I think what a first step, right, is to try and at least to an extent, try to have some idea about like the metrics that we care about or the principles that we care about, and maybe comfortable kind of either delaying something or thinking more deeply about something until we've understood the why. And I agree that like as things get more complex or as, you know, increasingly one algorithm, you know, the output of one is the input of the other one, the why gets really, really hard. And that's no exception there, if that makes sense. But that's been my experience, at least.
I also believe that it's so hard, like root cause analysis is always hard. As we use more complex machine learning models, it's even harder. But I'm also very encouraged to see if we can use the same optimization techniques, because it's like deep learning, any of those machine learning, they are like optimization tools for us. Can we use the same optimization tools to reach fairness? And there are some papers out there in the recent conferences. They talk about, for example, rather than optimizing over the global population, for example, optimizing for micro segments of the populations and getting to, for example, demographic parity. But of course, for products like machine translation is much more complex because the word embeddings, they can even be racist, and we know about all these problems. And it's really harder to kind of modify the objective functions to reach to the fairness in the context of, for example, machine translation. But I'm pretty optimistic that we can use the same technology to get there.
Yeah, and all I would add is I think it can be useful to just even simple techniques of altering your input to see how that impacts the output can give you a lot of insight into what might be happening, as well as to remember that with humans, we're bad at knowing why we make the decisions we do. We do a lot of post-hoc justification of our decisions. And so the causality is often not well understood there either.
Thank you to our great panel.
Yeah, thank you.
Round of applause.
All right, that's our show for today. To learn more about today's show or any of our panelists, visit twimlai.com/shows. Make sure you visit twimlcon.com/videos to secure your access to TwimlCon video content now. Peace.